Some good news, but still somewhat of a muddy picture for the health of the St. John's River. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And you can watch the show, too, video on demand with our partner, TVJax.com. And just ahead this morning, we'll take your calls on the new State of the St. John's River Report. What are your questions when it comes to the river? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, the feds bust a local doctor's office for scamming patients with unnecessary drug tests. A huge settlement. Plus, Culpepper on the Jags' tough loss yesterday to the Green Bay Packers. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, the 9th Annual State of the River Report, looking at the health of the Lower St. John's River Basin, is reporting mixed results. Here's the good news. Nitrogen levels in the river are down and grass beds are coming back, but salinity is up and algae blooms in the water are still a big problem. We've got a closer look right now as we welcome Dr. Gerard Pinto, research scientist with Jacksonville University. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Radha Piatti, professor and chair of the Department of Chemistry at the University of North Florida.
Good morning.
And Jimmy Orth with the St. John's Riverkeeper.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about the 9th Annual State of the St. John's River Report? What are your concerns about pollution in the river? What are your questions? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email, tweet us, weigh in on Facebook. Dr. Piatti, let's begin with you, and let's begin with the good news. This is the 9th annual report looking at the health of our major waterway. What are the positives in here?
The 9th State of the Lower St. John's River Basin Report is a collaboration between UNF, JU, Florida Southern College, and Valdosta State. It is available to the public at www.sjrreport.com, and it is supported by the Environmental Protection Board of the City of Jacksonville. As you noted, one of our findings this year has been that total nitrogen levels are starting to trend downward in a statistically significant trend. That's one of the positives that we see. As well, the toxics release inventory produced by the Environmental Protection Agency is showing that air emissions of toxic chemicals are also coming down.
Mm-hmm. That's the good news. Dr. Pinto, one visible way people have been able to observe problems in the river over the years are the bright green algae blooms that we see multiple times a year. That's still a big problem?
Algae blooms have been a problem for a long time with us up here. I guess we just have nutrients that go into the river. And even though nitrogen and phosphorus are basically food sources for those nutrients, and with the high temperatures and the amount of rain that we've had, that sort of really kicks off these algae blooms. Mm-hmm. And some of them are toxic.
Right. And let's talk about that. Jimmy Orth with the St. John's Riverkeeper. As you talk about this all over town, you've for years worked to sort of educate people about the big picture when it comes to the health of the river and why it's important. What are your thoughts about this report?
Well, I mean, I'm pleased about some of the results as far as reductions in nitrogen, but I think the thing that we have to realize is that we still are not in compliance. The river still has levels of nitrogen that do not meet state water quality standards. So our river is what they call impaired, mm-hmm. meaning that it is still polluted with too many nutrients. And so what we can see is the result of that is these algal blooms. And unfortunately, we're still seeing some major blooms throughout the region. I don't know if you saw the picture that we posted before of Doctor's Lake, where it was just completely green this summer. Actually, it was Dr. Pinto's picture that he took on an aerial survey of manatees. And there was a boat going right through the middle of it with some kids behind tubing. And that's a real concern because of the health risks that could be associated with some of these toxins. And we did some testing earlier this year of a bloom, and the toxin levels were through the roof. And this can cause all kinds of problems, like respiratory problems. It actually, some of them can actually cause liver failure if you ingest too much of this. Mm-hmm. So it's a big risk, and it's a problem because the nutrients are too high in the St. John's.
And if you're just tuning in, have you seen those bright green algae blooms in the river? What are your questions about the health of the St. John's River as we discuss the 9th Annual River Report? It's 549-2937 to join us. Would you, Dr. Piatti, would you swim in the St. John's River?
That's a very interesting question. I think there are definitely areas in the river where if there were public access, I would probably swim in the river.
So is it fair to say that the river is getting healthier overall based on the data in this report?
I think as you started in this interview, the results are mixed. Your question is the river getting healthier overall? I think there are some indicators that are gradually yielding to effort to improve the river's health. I think there are other areas where lots and lots of effort has been expended and not a lot of change has been observed yet. One of the particularly important ones of those is fecal coliform levels in the tributaries. Fecal coliform levels tell us about bacteria in the water body that we don't want. They're indicative not only of the presence of fecal coliform, but of other bacteria and viruses that are not removed by wastewater treatment. Mm-hmm. And so when those levels are persistently high in tributaries, that's another important issue that's honestly not getting – it's improving, but it's not anywhere near meeting water quality criteria yet.
And it's 549-2937 to join us. Now, one of the findings in this report, Dr. Pinto, is increased salinity in the St. Johns River. As Jaxport continues to try to find funding to dredge the river deeper to accommodate bigger cargo ships, what are your thoughts about that prospect? Here's an email from Rob in Murray Hill. Please talk about the potential impacts of increased salinity in the river from the proposed dredging.
Well, we have a very flat river. And there's a lot of tidal forcing that pushes salt water back up in, upstream. And so anytime you dig the river deeper or the channels deeper, you allow that tidal forcing to increase. And what that's going to do is increase the salinity pushing further upstream. A lot of the habitat further upstream is freshwater habitat, particularly grass beds, which is a very important type of habitat. So one of the impacts of that can be to kill back the grass beds. But there are a lot of things that affect salinity in the river. I mean, we have tides, we have weather patterns, droughts, hurricanes. These all cause the salinity to move up and down. A big thing is sea level rise. Sea level rise in itself is increasing the salinity in the river.
And that will continue to increase.
And that will be something that will continue going forward, yes.
What about that part of this? Jimmy Orth.
Well, yeah, I agree. I think one of our major concerns has been with the dredging is the increase in salinity that's anticipated. And as Dr. Pinto mentioned, with the rising sea levels, all this is going to do is exacerbate this increase in sea levels. And it's going to be, we're going to see the effects of this, of sea level rise much sooner than we would before. And the impacts are going to be much greater to the environment. And so that's one of the things we're really concerned about. We also look at what could potentially happen in Central Florida with water withdrawals from the St. Johns. They want to take hundreds mm-hmm. of millions of gallons of water out of the day daily. And that could also reduce the flow. As we talked about, a flat river that moves very slowly, reducing that flow would also allow salt water to push farther upstream. So I think we have to be anticipating the future and what potential impacts we're going to have on the St. Johns. And salinity is a big issue that we have to deal with.
We want your calls and questions right now as we look at the 9th Annual State of the St. John's Report. You can look at it online yourself at sjrreport.com. It's an interactive website with all the information. Lots of calls. Let's go to your questions right now at 549-2937. Karen in Fleming Island this morning. Hey, Karen, how's the river look down your way?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question regarding these toxic algae blooms. When the toxin levels are high, why isn't the health department issuing a health advisory to the citizens?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks for that. Dr. Piatti or Jimmy Orth?
Well, it's interesting. Unfortunately, in the state of Florida, we really don't have a criteria. Our Florida Department of Health does not have a criteria for issuing health advisories. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in terms of increasing the amount of sampling that we're doing. That's also a problem, that our agencies aren't getting out there and sampling these blooms in a timely manner. And they're also not, in a lot of cases, even doing toxic screens to see if there are toxins present. And so then that information has to translate to the mm-hmm. Department of Health, and then they don't really have a protocol or a criteria for how to issue those warnings. It's a big problem.
Hmm. 549-2937, John along Beach Boulevard right now. Hey, John, good morning to you. How are you today?
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question and a comment. What is the level of mercury in the river? Do anybody know? I fish off of one of the tributaries right there at Beach Boulevard, and I was catching fish with quite a few sores on their head, having them thrown back. Catfish, some whiteys, and that was a lot of them that was showing up with sores and spots on. I was wondering, was it mercury or what would be causing it?
Do you fish right there at beach by All Wet Sports? Is that the one you're talking about?
Right there. That's
yeah,
it.
I know exactly where that is. Okay, thanks for that. Dr. Piotti?
You bring up a great concern about mercury in fish tissue. And actually, across the state of Florida, there is a statewide TMDL, or total maximum daily load, that has been set by the state for mercury, because mercury has been found to be in elevated concentrations in fish tissue across the state, not just in the lower St. Johns River Basin. I think my colleague Dr. Pinto can speak a little bit about what we call gross external abnormalities and fishery sores and things like that. But mercury in fish tissue is a very important issue. And you're probably aware that the health department does produce a card or a set of guidelines on meal limits for a wide variety of fish species that shouldn't be eaten more than once a month or more than once a week or at all.
Dr. Pinto.
I think the question about sores on fish and gross external abnormalities, this was some data that was done way back before 2010. And so we don't really have any recent data on gross external abnormalities. When they have occurred, there haven't been that many of them. But, you know, every 10 or 15 years, we tend to see a little bit of a spike in some kind of organisms in the river that might cause these things. And the last time this happened, it was thought to be a fungus, an Amphanomyces fungus that caused these, and it could have been something that came in as a secondary infection. But it's something that we're not really that concerned about these days. I think we're more concerned about mercury, you know, heavy metals, things like these toxic algae blooms.
But people should still exercise caution if they're eating fish they catch in the river, depending on the type of fish.
Absolutely.
According to the health department's website.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that, you know, we get calls all the time asking, can I eat the fish in the river? And it's not an easy answer, because one, it's what type of fish, where was it caught? All of those factors have to be taken into consideration. For instance, if you're eating a fish higher on the food chain, they're going to have more mercury that has bioaccumulated into their fish tissue and be potentially exposing you to more mercury. Also, where is it caught? I've always said, like, for instance, I would not eat a fish that is a bottom feeder in the Ortega River. The sediments and the legacy pollution in those sediments is so high. That's one of the most contaminated areas for contaminated sediments in the St. Johns. And so I would not eat a fish like a catfish or something from that area. So I think you just have to use caution and be careful and limit the amount of fish, unfortunately, that we eat from the river.
Lots of calls from all over the listening area as we talk about the new state of the St. Johns River report, including Amy, who's along the Ortega River right now. Hi, Amy. How are you?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
First of all, hello, Jerry and Jimmy.
Hi.
This is Amy Pullman. Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a two-part question, and it's great to hear you guys talking. I have not read the report. First of all, how do you feel about restoration of the Akawaha? Will that possibly happen? Secondly, is there a possibility of maybe purchasing credits, having ticketing, I don't know, something to kind of mitigate the, I guess, the withdrawal from the springs and the pollution down in Central Florida as far as intrusion into the Florida and aquifer. And I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you guys for being on this morning.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Well, I'll just say that, and thanks for calling in, Amy, by the way. I'll just say that, you know, the Ocklawaha River used to supply 40% of the freshwater input to the St. Johns River. It is, or used to be, the major tributary to the St. Johns River. And so anytime you remove freshwater from an estuary, you can cause some tremendous ecological problems. So, you know, if that was a possibility, if there is a possibility to restore that, that would be good. Of course, in our political climate, whether that will materialize or not is anybody's guess.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, the Akawaha is an important, I think, component to actually restoring the overall health of the St. John's. It is the largest tributary of the St. John's. It does provide a major source of fresh water to the river, and restoring that at the ecological functions of that natural system would be, I think, a huge benefit for the St. John's overall.
Okay, Dave in Nassau County now. Hi, Dave. Good morning. Thanks for holding here on the air. Yeah, hi.
Thank you. I have a couple of quick questions. First is, since Florida generates an awful lot of its electrical power from coal, is that what's causing the mercury level in the fish to rise? And my second question is, how much impact does the Georgia Pacific pollution have on the St. John's River system? And I'll take my response off the air.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Wow, really good informed questions today on this topic. I love it. Dr. Piatti.
The question about coal-fired power plants yielding much of the mercury in the water is right on the money. It is generally these kinds of facilities that put a lot of mercury into the air, and then via deposition from the air, that mercury gets into the water body and into the lower level of the food chain, which constant bioaccumulates as it goes up the food chain. So that's very mm-hmm. correct. And the second question was about Georgia Pacific's contribution.
And they were successful in getting a pipeline installed that discharges their effluent right into the water, right into the middle of the river. So that's been controversial.
It has. I think that one of the things that we are lacking in our report is more information about macroinvertebrate communities. There was some work done in the area of the Georgia Pacific outfall before and after it that showed that the effects of that outfall were very most likely to have caused a change in the population diversity in that area. And so that's some of the only evidence that we have that speaks to that. If we could get some more sampling of macroinvertebrate communities and how they might change, not just with pollution like that, but also with salinity changes, that would be tremendous.
The Environmental Protection Board of Jacksonville has just tweeted the show. The EPB is conducting a study of mercury in the Duval County environment right now, studying air and water levels. We will definitely want to hear more about that. A few emails from listeners. I hope people realize that the health of the river, the local economy, and the quality of life for all of Jacksonville is interconnected. Emails one listener. Thanks for that. And here's a question for you. Jimmy Orth, Scott wants to know, every time I look at the St. John's River, I see white floating bubbles that follow the currents of the river for miles. What is that?
I'm going to actually turn that over to the scientists in the room because I know it has something to do with carbon. And
okay. Well, and is that a concern?
Well, no, it's not really a concern. I mean, in 2010, it was a concern because we had some unusual things going on in the river that year. And as if I recall correctly, we had a high level of dolphin deaths that we don't usually get. We had fish kills, we had algae blooms, and we had this white foam that would get, you know, almost a foot high in places. Mm-hmm. One of our esteemed colleagues at JU did a study on that foam. This is Dr. Lucy Sonnenberg with the Miller-Wilson Environmental Chemistry Lab, and found that this was mainly protonaceous and organic matter that could have probably built up from some of these fish gills and things mm-hmm. in the river. But generally, you know, you'll get wind that will create some kinds of shallow upwelling that will create these foam lines in the water. And they almost look parallel sometimes. You can see them. But nothing of real concern, I would have thought.
Go ahead.
And we get calls about that a lot, too. And I think it's something we just tell people that, you know, if there's not a really large accumulation of it, then it's probably okay. If there is a large accumulation, it could be actually something, some type of chemical or something that's been discharged in the river. And so it could be of concern. So I appreciate people keeping their eye out, though, and their concerns, even though they may not know, you know, what they're looking at. If they can report it, at least we can determine if it's something that's a problem.
I think once we had something called firefighting foam in the water,
mm-hmm.
And this is going back, you know, over a decade or so, more than that even. And the thing about that kind of foam is it sort of has an iridescent kind of chemical look to it. And so you can distinguish it in that sense, too.
Lots of calls, emails, and tweets as we look at the 9th Annual State of the St. John's River Report. You can look at it online at sjrreport.com. One bright spot, the highest manatee count recorded in 22 years, our panel says, and they attribute a lot of that to stronger regulations, better boating speed zones, raised awareness. That's good news. Let's go to Tina in Jacksonville. Hey, Tina. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Good morning to your panel. I just wanted to kind of also let you guys know that the Environmental Protection Agency actually will be in town on the 28th of September, and that's to discuss their published plan about the cleanup of the Kerr McGee site, which is the old herbicide pesticide site over on Tallarin on the St. John's River. And I just wanted to know from your panel, how does that site impact the health of the St. John's River?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. I didn't know about that. Thanks for that. Jimmy Orth or Dr. Piatti?
I guess the one answer I would give you is that a lot of those legacy sites have had impacts that would naturally involve some degree of runoff, although I don't know what the precise cause and effect issues are related to that particular site. I think that I would also extend that to say that one of the things we're interested in doing on the River Report team is localizing the report for neighborhoods such as the one around Kerr McGee and others. And so we have I always say every year that anyone who can hear the sound of my voice is invited to contact us and ask us to give them a talk. Mm-hmm. We would love to speak with you about your neighborhood and your tributary. We have sections written on 29 individual tributaries in the Lower Basin, and we've revamped our website this year to allow people to actually search by council district and by planning district to look and see what kinds of information there is about tributaries or the main stem that's related to their particular area of Duval County, yeah, or of the Lower Basin.
And again, that website is sjrreport.com. Joe in Atlantic Beach. Go ahead, Joe.
Hello. I'm a professional geologist. I'd like to correct a misunderstanding that's been offered, and I heard it again this morning. And that is the role of the Rodman Dam in the hydrology of the river. It does not stop any fresh water from getting to the St. John's. It just makes it work harder to get there. The only way to reduce the flow of fresh water from the the St. John's is to decrease the rainfall on the drainage basin. That rain that falls has to go to the river somehow. The dam just makes it work harder to get there. It slows it down, but it does not impede, or I shouldn't say, it does not stop the flow of fresh water to the St. John's. It's a fallacy, and I've pointed this out before, and nobody wants to acknowledge it.
Okay. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Okay. Is he right? Jimmy Orth.
Well, I don't want to take away from the River Report because that's not really a part of it, but I'll just say that the dam does impede the natural hydrology of the river and those natural pulses of water that it provides to the St. John's. It also, because of that huge reservoir.
But it's not completely blocking.
Right.
Is what the point he was
exactly
making.
And because of that huge reservoir, we see a lot of evaporation from the pool, and we also see that it's suppressing springs. There's about 20 springs that are suppressed. The flow of those springs, which would provide natural fresh water to the St. John's, have been suppressed. So,
okay, and let's take another call. It's Mike. He lives on the river. Hey, Mike, where are you along the river?
I'm in Picolata.
Oh, okay. Good morning.
I can look across the river and see the Georgia Pacific plant. I disagree with Jimmy about the Okawaha. It's a wonderful habitat right now, and there practically is as much water coming out of the Okawaha through the locks as there would be if they tore the dam down. But I agree with Jimmy on just about everything else. The dredging is terrible. We're going to dredge a river. We're going to spend, how much is it, $1 billion? And there's a good chance that the Panamax ships are not going to come to Jacksonville anyway. So all we're going to do is have more saltwater incursion into the aquifer, which we're very concerned about down here in Picolata, because when it gets dry, we do have saltwater incursion into the into the aquifer.
Okay. Yeah, thanks for that, Mike. Thank you for lots of great calls today. Dr. Piatti, let's close with you. People, again, can go to the website to learn more at sjrreport.com.
Yes, and it's really important to us that the public use this report, that the public either look at the big watershed if that's what they want, or they look at their little part of town to see, you know, what tributary do they drive over? Is it healthy? What's happening if it's not healthy? We want people to know that.
It's the 9th annual St. John's River, State of the St. John's River Report at sjrreport.com. Thank you so much, Dr. Gerard Pinto, research scientist at JU, Dr. Radha Piatti, professor, chair of the Department of Chemistry at UNF, and Jimmy Orth with the St. John's River Keeper. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Much more still ahead later. Culpepper, a look at this year's First Coast Heart Walk. But up next, drug testing built local patients out of their money, patients who were not abusing drugs. We'll tell you about a major settlement right after this.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
On the next episode of Hometown, the Tales program matches together local shelter dogs and inmates for training and rehabilitation. We Care's Beaches Health and Wellness program partners with local organizations to provide social and medical services to people in need. Family Foundation's 1000 and 1000 program develops personalized strategies to help the working poor escape poverty. And local musician Monique Cancera performs her song, Nowhere to Go. Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
And good morning. I'm Kevin Mersch, our producer for First Coast Connect here on WJCT. We are in our fall fun drive. We're here to ask for your support for this program and everything you enjoy here on 89.9. If you enjoyed that great conversation we just had involving the health of the St. John's River, well, that's what we bring to you every single day. That's what I think about when I try to produce this show of what would be interesting topics. What do people want to talk about? And we work to put those things together and bring it to you. And we're able to do that because listeners like you show your financial support. So far, we've raised about just shy of $5,300 for the drive. We want to raise about $72,000. So we need your help. Make that call now, 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go online at wjct.org. And don't forget, join us for $10 a month at the sustainer level of $10 a month, or just a straight $120, and we will send you a nice stainless steel water bottle as our way of saying thanks. Our thank you to you for calling in your pledge of support. So make that call right now. We're going to go back to the program, 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, and thank you very much for your support.
Welcome back. Well, it's a huge settlement amount paid to the federal government. Coastal Spine and Pain of Jacksonville is agreeing to pay out $7 million for medically unnecessary drug tests. Investigators say Coastal was testing patients of all ages and backgrounds indiscriminately at a cost of up to $1,000 per test for a wide array of drugs. Now, this is one of the first cases of its kind in the country, and it raises interesting questions about our healthcare policy, because the physicians at Coastal were making a lot more money testing patients for these very unnecessary screenings for possible drug abuse than actually treating the patients. Jason Mehta is with the U.S. Attorney's Office and joins us now. And Jason, we're talking about doctors testing senior citizens for use of cocaine and ecstasy and things like that, people who would not normally fit that profile. Is that right?
That's right, Melissa. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. You know, all across the country, we're struggling with pain addiction problems, opioid problems, heroin addiction problems. And one of the ways that the federal government's trying to address this is by allowing doctors and encouraging doctors to test patients where it's appropriate for drug abuse issues.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But there's specific rules, and you don't test everyone for everything, and you don't test them every time, and you don't confirm it if there's no reason to. But what we saw here with Coastal and what we're seeing across the entire country, really, is that, as you said, many doctors are making more money testing patients than actually treating patients.
So give me an example of what they were doing that was inappropriate.
Yeah, absolutely. So the rules say that as a general matter, you can test patients if you have a reason to suspect drug abuse or if you have a reason to suspect there might be concerns. What we saw here is that every patient, whether it was a 20-year-old military personnel or whether it was a 90-year-old grandmother, was being tested for every drug under the sun. And that goes from, as you said, cocaine to MDMA to ecstasy to everything else.
So grandma, they were telling grandma to submit to a cocaine and ecstasy test at a cost of $1,000.
That's right. And what made this particularly troubling really is that Coastal, like other groups, didn't just test the grandmother one time. What would happen is that even when that test was negative, even when there was no reason to suspect grandmother was taking drugs, then there was a subsequent additional test, and that was the one that was $1,000 a pop.
Wow. And how was this all discovered?
Well, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we're using a lot more data analytics and a lot more data measures to try to track expenditures. And what we're seeing nationwide is that drug testing is the fastest growing growth sector in the Medicare program, more expenses for drug testing than anything else. And when we looked at that at a local level, Coastal kind of really stood out to us.
Mm-hmm. And how much do you think Coastal Spine made off of these scam drug tests over the years?
Well, and, I should point out that some of these tests are appropriate, but we thought many were not. In all, what we noted is from August of 2015 to the present, Coastal made about $3.5 million, and they're agreeing to pay back double that. Because
Wow. What
we found was that the vast majority, if not all, were medically unnecessary and inappropriate.
They're paying the government $7 million.
That's right.
Are they admitting any wrongdoing?
No. So this is a civil settlement. There is no admission of wrongdoing. But, the settlement amount reflects some degree of concern.
What advice do you have for medical consumers when they hear these types of horror stories? What sorts of questions should they be asking when it's recommended they have a test or a screening and so forth?
Well, as a general matter, healthcare consumers need to trust their doctors, right? And the vast majority, 99% plus, are doing the right thing every single time. And in many instances, Coastal was doing the right thing every single time. But, there are times where kind of profits take place over healthcare considerations, and that's unfortunate. So my best advice is that for consumers, trust your doctors, but ask tough questions and ask if everything you're getting is actually necessary.
Always good to talk to you. Thanks for sharing this fascinating local story with us.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Jason Mehta is with the U.S. Attorney's Office announcing details of a massive settlement, Coastal Spine paying $7 million to the government for inappropriate drug tests. Much more still ahead. We'll be back in a moment.
WJCT presents Rachel Rippey, our 2016 American Graduate Champion of the First Coast, dedicated to mentoring our youth.
Vertical is a support program for students with intellectual disabilities in Jacksonville and really can be from anywhere that want to come to college.
To hear more stories of champions, watch American Graduate Day on WJCT, Saturday, September 17th at 1 p.m.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First are proud to present the 4th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire teachers. Saturday, October 8th at the Hyatt Regency Riverfront Hotel. Tickets are only $30. Spend the day sharing ideas with colleagues, learning new ways to engage students, and empowering yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets now. WJCT.org/teach.
Classical music is available 22 hours a day on WJCT 89.9 FM HD2. Find out how you can listen to classical music by calling 358-6390. Enjoy classical music, day or night, on 89.9 HD2.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Heart Walk is the largest event of its kind in Jacksonville. Every year it brings together walk teams, individual walkers, survivors of heart disease and stroke, and their families, all working towards a healthier lifestyle and raising funds and awareness to combat heart disease and stroke, the number one and number five killers of American men and women in this country. Now, the Heart Walk is coming up this Saturday in downtown Jacksonville at Metropolitan Park, right next to our WJCT studios. We've got a preview right now as we speak with Dr. Thomas Flipsey, cardiologist at Mayo Clinic. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
And heart transplant recipient Elmo Aquino. Good to talk to you.
Good morning.
In a moment, we'll speak to the doctor about just the big picture on this. But first, I'd love to hear your personal story. You underwent a successful heart transplant. Can you tell us what brought you to that point?
Yes, I was diagnosed when I was 29 years old. And lived with the basically dilated cardiomyopathy. Uh-huh. And in 2006, my condition started to worsen. And in 2007, I had a heart transplant.
And what was that like for you? That's a major procedure. Well, scary, I would think.
before the transplant, yes. The doctors at Mayo always told me that eventually I would have to get a heart transplant.
Uh-huh.
So things just started going downhill. Had to get a defibrillator put in, and then I had to get a Jarvik pump put in. So they're doing all these bridges in order for me to get the heart that was right for me.
Yeah, and then that can be an ordeal in and of itself.
Yes, it was.
How long did you have to wait for a heart?
Waited almost a year, and it was actually the stroke. I had a stroke around Memorial Day 2007 that put me at the top of the list.
Really?
So, after I had the stroke around Memorial Day, it was June 3rd that I had the transplant.
And how are you doing today? What's the before and after like for you?
I would say that the doctors at Mayo did a really, really good job because I've actually had two children since the transplant.
Oh, so. Congratulations. And healthy. Are you going to be walking in the Heart Walk this Saturday?
Yes, I'll be walking. I'll walk every year and try and raise funds for the for a great cause.
Dr. Flipsey, Elmo's story is really heartwarming, no pun intended. It's always great to see not only Mayo Clinic, but the American Heart Association being able to share a successful outcome like that. Because for a lot of Americans, it's not a happy ending.
That's correct. Yes, ma'am. As you mentioned earlier, heart disease is the leading cause of death in the United States. It accounts for about one in every three deaths in this country, both men and women. And put another way, 2,200 people die daily from heart disease, or one every 39 seconds.
Mm-hmm. The leading killer is still in this country. And so the Heart Walk is one way to raise money, raise awareness, and promote health, get people out moving.
Yes, ma'am, absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us about the event.
Well, I don't know much from the organizational standpoint. I do know that I think 20,000 people, I might be wrong on those numbers, will take part. And it's an opportunity for patients, families, interested folks who want to live a healthy lifestyle to all get involved. There are corporate sponsors as well. But the main purpose is to raise awareness about heart disease and to raise funds to help fight this condition.
Sure. Now, in your case, Elmo, you had was it a hereditary condition?
They said that it was, I had the flu, then I had a virus basically attacked.
Okay.
And caused me to have the dilated cardiomyopathy.
For a lot of Americans, it may not be something like that. It may be heart disease may come upon them because of sometimes genetics, but also sometimes lifestyle choices, which the Heart Association is trying to encourage people to get serious about changing, which is easier said than done for a lot of people. But basic common sense health advice, we can never repeat it too often.
Sure. It's always diet and exercise.
Yeah.
So that's
diet and exercise. Don't smoke. Don't eat a lot of fatty foods. everything your mom told you, eat your vegetables. I'm sure you talk to your patients about this all the time.
It's the same story, every patient, every day.
Yeah. And are they listening? Do you feel like the message is starting to penetrate more than it used to?
I believe so, yes, ma'am. You see more people out exercising, and I think there's a greater awareness of what a healthy diet should be if people don't always follow it. But at least they know they're getting the message.
Yeah. Well, it's really great to speak to both of you because there are so many walks and 5Ks in Jacksonville, but this is one of the biggest ones, and this is one that brings together a lot of great people. It is the First Coast Heart Walk, the largest such event of its kind in the city, and it's happening Saturday, this Saturday, September 17th, kicking off bright and early at downtown Metropolitan Park at 8 a.m., Not too late to mark your calendar to participate. You can show up and register right on site. Register ahead of time. But be part of it. Get out and walk this weekend and support the American Heart Association. He is Elmo Aquino, heart transplant recipient, and Dr. Thomas Flipsey, cardiologist with Mayo Clinic. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And again, that event is Saturday morning. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, homicide rates nationwide are much lower than they were in the 1990s, but new analysis indicates rates are going up a lot in 25 of the nation's biggest cities, including Chicago, Cleveland, and Baltimore. What's behind this conflicting trend in urban homicide?
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Do you have music you want people to hear? Do you have an artistic vision you want to share? Then join these winners in The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit your work now through September 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, a tough loss over the weekend for Jaguars fans as they lose to the Green Bay Packers.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
A very close week one game for the team. Cole Pepper's on the line now with a look at that and the rest of the week's sports news and notes. Hey, Cole, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, it was a tough loss, particularly when you consider the Jaguars had a chance. They were down 4 late in the game, had a chance to convert on a fourth down, and perhaps pull what would have been a pretty substantial upset over the one of the best teams in the NFC, the Green Bay Packers, yesterday. They couldn't convert the fourth down. A little bit of a questionable play call, but there are some real positives that came out of that game. While the players afterwards were saying there's no such thing as a moral victory at this point, the Jaguars, I think, showed that they have made progress. They are a better team this year.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, when you play well against a top team, when you're in the game until the last minute, that's certainly a real step forward. Luke Jokel on the left side of the offensive line certainly has been under fire quite a bit in the preseason and last year, but played very well there. What the Jaguars are lacking right now more than anything is a pass rush off the edge. And this was has been an issue for several years. They drafted Dante Fowler Jr. last year. They drafted a player named Yannick Ngakoue in the third round this past year. These two young pass rushers are going to have to develop. The difficult thing is that those kinds of players usually are not impact players their first year. So at some point, they're going to have to find a way to get a pass rush. And these first four games for the Jaguars, key for their season, because they're taking on four very accomplished quarterbacks. Aaron Rodgers, the two-time MVP yesterday. This week they go to San Diego to take on the Chargers and Phillip Rivers. And they'll also have Joe Flacco, who's been a Super Bowl quarterback, and also Andrew Luck and the Colts. So in these first four games, getting pressure on the quarterback is going to be particularly important. We'll see how it all plays out. They've not played well traditionally on the West Coast, so that'll be something they'll have to overcome as they go to San Diego this weekend.
Yeah, yeah. And there was so much excitement during the game. It was interesting. You know, it was a close loss. It was, you know, definitely kind of a heartbreaker that it was so close. What else is going on?
Well, obviously, college football getting underway over the last couple weekends. And this past weekend, Florida looked terrific. They blew out a really terrible Kentucky team. Kentucky is just not good at all. I still think there are some questions about how good Florida is, but they did find their way into the top 25. They've won their first two games against lesser competition. See how it plays out going forward. How good the offense is certainly is going to be a question. I think the defense is going to be terrific at Florida. I don't have any question about that at this point. But how they do moving forward is obviously a big part of the storyline for fans around here. Florida State had an easy time of it, as you would expect, against Charleston Southern. Big blowout victory for FSU. There's no really never a doubt about what was happening there. But Georgia had a tough time against Nichols, of all things. A school that used to be called Nichols State, now just Nichols. And Georgia struggled, won by two, but that was all they had. This is the first year with Kirby Smart as a head coach there. They had started a freshman quarterback. You can kind of give them a little bit of a pass. But they're going to have to respond as they move forward, certainly. And with all three kind of area teams winning, we'll be keeping an eye on how that all plays out with the Florida-Georgia game, of course, coming up at the end of October.
Very nice. And by the way, you've got a podcast up that people can follow, a really good one after the Jaguars' loss. It's the Sam and Cole podcast. To follow Cole on social media, check that out on his Twitter, at Cole Pepper. Always great to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Melissa, thank you.
Okay, and we're out of time for the rest of the show. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow, but right now we are going to talk a little bit about how we want to thank you, our listeners, for our fall funding drive. Thanks to everyone who's called in already this morning, but we need you to keep calling with a little bit more about how to do that. Here's our First Coast Connect producer, Kevin Mershart.
And good morning. The number you can call is 353-9528. That's 353-WJCT or 1-800-722-9528. As we said, I'm Kevin Mershart, producer for First Coast Connect. We're here to bring you great programming every single day, and we do that thanks to the support of listeners just like you. So if you enjoyed today's program, we had a great conversation on the St. John's River. Tomorrow, we're going to have a conversation with JU Professor Steve Baker in regard to the area soon to be having two freshman members of Congress, and how will that affect things on the First Coast when it comes to funding and other things in Congress. Give us a call so we can always bring you these kinds of programs. That number again is 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528. Think of some of the great things we brought you in the recent past. You have the new WJCT app. A lot of you people, I'm sure, have on your phone. Remember, It's a Wonderful Life. We had the local voice talenting, that radio drama produced here at WJCT. We have Relax Radio Overnights, many other programs, many other events that have been brought to you here through WJCT. It's all made possible because of support of listeners like you. So make that call right now, and thank you very much. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528, or go to wjct.org. Right there in the corner, there's a little box marked support. Click on that, fill in your information. All that, and it's a nice secure website, so you don't have to worry about that with your credit card or anything else. And you can become a sustainer. Make that $10 a month. That's what a lot of people do. $10 a month, it sits on your credit card. You don't have to worry about it anymore. And if you do that, we will send you a lovely little thank you gift, and that is a stainless steel water bottle. It's our way of saying thank you. It has a big thank you on it. Shows you our support for you and all the programs you enjoy here on WJCT, including First Coast Connect. We have Diane Rehm coming up, the kind of programs that you always enjoy. If that's important to you, we want to make sure this is always here for you. Fact of the matter is, none of this stuff comes really all that inexpensively. It costs money to produce programs. It costs money to bring you programs from all around the world and all the news from around the world. All of that made possible, though, because of listeners like you showing your financial support. So do it right now. 353-9528. 1-800-722-9528. Go online at wjct.org. If you think about all the programming that we bring you, think of all the stuff that you listen to on the weekends when you're tuning in, and during the week, you hear programs like Fresh Air, you like the programs like All Things Considered, you enjoy the music we bring you in the evenings, and we're able to do that because of listeners like you, and it's such a unique programming. Think of the music that we bring you. We have people coming in here producing music. It's not some... it's not generated by some computer somewhere. Well, you may have heard stories about how some of the commercial stations, how do they pick their music? Well, there's only owned by so many companies, and they have their plug it in there, and here's how we bring it in. Do you hear independent songs? No. Do you hear artists that you don't hear all the time? No. Up and comers, old music, oldies and stuff, things that you just aren't going to hear anywhere else, that's made possible because you... the listener, say, that is what I want. I don't want the stuff that I get everywhere else. We bring you programs that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only made possible because of listeners like you showing your financial support. So give us a call right now, and thank you very much. Once again, the number is 353-9528. That's 353-WJCT or 1-800-722-9528 or go online at wjct.org. Thank you very much. Diane Rehm coming up in just a few moments. We have another great program for you. We'll be back here tomorrow for First Coast Connect. Tune in. We have lots of great stuff coming up this week. I know I'm the producer. I'm the one who helped put all this stuff together. We have some great programming this week for you. And always remember, it's here because listeners like you show your support. Call now. Thank you very much. 353-9528, 1-800-722-9528. And thank you very much for your support.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.